Okay, first thing we're going to do, we got a little song here for you. This is a great song. I don't know if any of you ever heard it before. It's by a guy named Andrus Osborne. It's called Living in the Mind of a Junkie. Song, I love it. I have a wealth of friends, and with my AA friends, an unusual quality of fellowship. For to these people, I am truly related. First through mutual pain and despair, and later through mutual objectives and newfound faith and hope. Not a keys to the kingdom. So I'm Terry. I'm still an addict, alcoholic.
Terry.
So Drop the Rock is this session. So Drop the Rock is, there's a book that's really popular. They just came out with a sequel to it. Where it originated was a woman wrote an article to the Grapevine about dropping the rock. And then Sandy Beach, who is a famous AA international speaker who passed away, he made it really famous when he spoke at 1976 International in and talked about dropping the rock. It is a way of really looking at character defects. So that's what this particular one is about. So if you want to open the books, it says page 2. So step 6, entire rid of God, remove all these defects of character, and then humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. What it says, if we read it, is it says, for a child ready to have who?
God,
right? Does it say you? Does it say your sponsor? No. You know, ultimately what the steps do is they get us into a place where we can create a relationship with the spirit of the universe. The way that you ever, however you want to see that spirit. That will then give us the ability to change. So step 6 says we're tired to have God remove all these. And then step 7, humbly ask who? God, right? They used the word Him, but that was because that was how the traditions were. But when I say the traditions, throughout religious life, from the beginning of time, they always referred to God as some man figure. Now, obviously, anyone that studies any amount of theology comes to a place where they realize that God is a lot bigger than any particular gender. But that's how they show. So we humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. So it does not say me. It does not say my sponsor. So let's go ahead and do the 7-step prayer together. If you guys will, you want to lead us in it?
Sure. 7-step prayer. My Creator,
I am now willing that you should have all of me,
good and bad.
I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding.
Amen.
Okay, so it's quite clear that if we're working these 2 steps, our job is to identify. That's what the inventory process will do. And we looked at some other ways of self-examination in the previous workbooks, right? Aside from just straight up inventories. So that we could take a look at where we're at and what's blocking us, right? And so what do we need to do to move forward? So, so if we're really working on these steps, what we've done is we've done our work, which is to identify to the best of our abilities what these things are that we want to have removed. I have no more power to remove my own defects of character than I do to stay sober on my own power. It's just beyond me. So if you're working on 6 and 7, it should mean that you're using the tools available to identify and name the defects that you have found objectionable in your life that you want to give to God to get rid of. So the next page on 3, it says step 6 and 7 are often referred to as the lost steps. In the big book of AA on page 76, it comprised 2 paragraphs. In the 12 and 12, it was written 13 years later. Those 2 paragraphs became 14 pages. And this is my belief, that if Bill were around today, there'd be at least 164 pages on character defects. Character defects are dogged, right? They keep popping back up. You've heard the analogies, I'm sure, of like whack-a-mole. You get one under control, another one pops up, and it's a challenging thing. So simply put, character defects and shortcomings are the things that block us from being truly free. They cut us off from God, our fellow travelers, and recovery in our families. My defects of character and shortcomings are invisible blocks that form a wall between you and me and God. So think about what I just said there. That character defects are invisible blocks that put a wall between me and you and me and God. So I can't get sober on my own. The first word of the 12 steps is we. I need you to help me to see the truth about myself. So I've had this experience in recovery where I have had like this, it's like a wall between me and people where I can see them, but I can't feel them. And that's what character defects do. So I have to really try to live my life with this rigorous honesty that they call us to try to live my life in a transparent way. Our program says this. we will be happy, joyous, and free. It says we're sure that that's what God wants for us. And then it also goes on to say that we will be rocketed to the fourth dimension. Another dimension of existence. Happy, joyous, and free, rocketed to another dimension. That sounds pretty damn good to me, right? So I want to live with that kind of freedom, but I can't do that if I have this thing that blocks me from really being able to truly feel the people that are around me. I have spent a tremendous amount of time in my life sleepwalking. So there are four basic reasons we won't be entirely ready to work the six and the seven steps. The first one is a conscious decision that we will never give up a specific character defect. Made a decision, I'm going to hold on to that shit, I don't care. The next is we blame our defects on other people, situations, or institutions. You know, it's because of the DOC, the prisons, or whatever it is, or my ex and the child support I pay, whatever it is. Third, we rationalize. Our capacity to rationalize is unlimited. Before recovery, we spent years on this one, throwing up barriers against unpleasant realities. And then fourth, finally, it's denial. We are totally unaware of our contribution to the problem. By working the six and seven step, we are less likely in recovery to stay stuck in old, unproductive, negative behaviors. The action of the sixth and seventh step culminates in dropping the rock. All the stubborn, grasping, stupid holding on to patterns of behavior, thinking and feeling that are harmful to our progress in recovery. So if you turn the page, I've had conversations over the last couple of days with people about character defects. Clarence Snyder, who was, his story in the book was the home brewmeister, that's what they call him, the home brewmeister. And Clarence, he produced a massive list of character defects that he would provide to people so that they could identify. I put some of them here. The last step work, I just did a step workshop in Arizona, and I took like 150 guys through the steps out of these new workbooks that I produced to create something that was radically different. And in that one, I didn't put any prompts because what I wanted people to do is use meditation to look more inwardly to try to find. So what I'm getting at is, as I work recovery, sometimes I need to change things up and I need to look at things with a, using Chuck C's term, a new pair of glasses. And that new pair of glasses is what helps me. Chuck is the one who got famous, wrote the book, A New Pair of Glasses, AA Classic. But where he actually heard that was from Bill's spiritual advisor, a guy named Father Ed Dowling, was the one who told him that, hey man, you got to start to look at things sometimes through a new pair. So you could. So when you're doing this exercise, there's the list. Add to the list. Circle any of the below that apply to you. So there's the seven deadly sins. There's an acronym for it. Acronym is a way to remember something, right? Letters. So pale gas is the one I was taught, which is pride, anger, lust, envy, gluttony, avarice, and sloth. So you just look at that stuff. The seven deadly needs from a book named that by Edward Baer, who's in the program, the need to know, the need to be right, the need to get even, the need to look good, the need to keep score. Anybody relate to any of that? Anybody in here have the need to know? I want to know. I know. The need to be right? Oh, shit. I've fought that my whole life. The need to get even. The need to look good. It's all good. Peace. The need to judge. I'll judge the hell out of somebody. The need to keep score. I did that for you. What's he done for me lately, you know? And then the need to control. And then there were the seven deadly fears that he had in a following book called Fear of Intimacy. Fear of the unknown, fear of change, fear of rejection or abandonment, fear of conflict or confrontation, fear of becoming a burden, and fear of dying. Okay, so I'm going to put on something real quick. We're going to go into Drop the Rock. And here it is. This is a 3 minute. This is 3 minutes of Sandy Beach, who passed away, by the way. Sandy died in an AA meeting. Sandy was probably one of the... If you have never listened to this man, his talks are all over YouTube, all over recovery places. This guy did it. And he did it and faced tremendous things. He lost a couple kids. He had a daughter that was murdered. I mean, this guy, like, walked through the fire and still maintained his peace because it came from a power that was greater than him. And so he made Drop the Rock famous in Alcoholics Anonymous with this 3 minutes.
There's one last thing that I think you have to do in order to have the miracle of AA take place. All you have to do, if you do, is don't drink, turn your life over to God, and get rid of all of your old ideas. That's all we ask.
That's all you got to do. So you got the picture. So you start talking about Drop the Rock, right? Understand. So rocks, people always picture, and the way he does, I got a 150-pound rock. Well, yeah, we all had that 150-pound rock. We were all drowning in the sea of alcoholism or drug addiction, and we all had a 150-pound rock. We already have experience with dropping the rock because we had our drug addiction. Our alcoholism was killing us, right? And so we were willing to take some actions that allowed us to drop that rock. But so what happened, and the reason that there was only two paragraphs in the big book and 14 pages later, is because the belief when AA first started was this: work your steps, help others, trust God, and, you know, clean house, do all this stuff, and you will be free. And so they believed that whatever character defects you had would be removed, just like alcohol, in their case, had been removed. And then what they found out through practical experience, and that's why I like the 12 and 12 so much, because the 12 and 12 is really the universal experience of AA groups of the time and what had really happened. And what they found is that these character defects kept coming back. Why would somebody hold on to something that wasn't serving them? It's because it's hard to let go of that stuff. Little dishonesties. I was talking to one of my buddies back here, and he was telling me about being clean and sober and hiding smoking from his wife. And I think, man, that was funny, right? That, I mean, that's like, you know, he go run, oh, I'll go for a run. He goes someplace to smoke. And the minute he said that, it made me think of my own experience with this, right? So I quit smoking cigarettes when I was 2 years sober. So I'm not smoking. And then at one point, cigars became really popular. And everybody would sit around, all my buddies, and now, hey, man, let's have a fire pit meeting. And we sit around and light cigars and talk. And in the beginning of my life in recovery, before I got sober, I used to live my life when I was home in the backyard. If I was smoking crack, I was always gone on a crack run. But we had a back patio, and on the back patio I had a TV and a bar and a television and a stereo system. And I would sit outside and I would smoke cigarettes and drink liquor and watch my sporting events or listen to my music. And my wife and my kids were on the other side of the glass. That's a pretty tragic way to live if you really think about it. You know, I wanted to be a part of their life, but I didn't even realize I was disconnected from them. And my wife would come over to the glass, and she'd go tap on the glass, and the kids would wave, say goodnight to your dad, and they'd wave to dad, and they'd go in and go to bed. I was on the other side of the glass, right? So I'm smoking cigars for a while, and one night I'm sitting on the back porch, right, because I ain't going to smoke cigars in the house, and I'm smoking a cigar out there. And my wife comes up to the glass and she says, "Good night, honey. I'm going to bed." And there I was, 15 years sober, on the other side of the glass again. That's a character defect, right? I mean, I want to be in relationship. I want to experience love. I want to be a part of it. So a simple way to say, what's got you on the other side of the glass? That's a character defect, right? So that was my character defect. So I decided I'm done with these cigars. So to get off cigars, a buddy of mine said, "Well, man, here's how I did. I used this stuff called dip." Make perfect sense to me, right? To get off of drugs, I went to methadone. I mean, shit, and all that makes sense to me. So I started dipping. Well, I knew my wife wouldn't like dip, and I think it's pretty, you got spit everywhere. So I start dipping, and I hide it. My wife doesn't know I'm, so I'm right there with you, brother. My wife doesn't know I'm dipping. I hide the dip. I go and I buy a can of dip. And when I take dips, my nitrate substance, by the way, holy shit, man, it made me dizzy. It made me dizzy and sick. Here is the effect on me when I smoke a cigar or dip. If I smoke a cigar or dip, I have nightmares. I get dry mouth. I mean, horribly dry mouth. And I can't sleep. Who the fuck would smoke a cigar? No. Oh, and then, it makes you smell horrible. Wow, what a value. How could I have some more of that? But I'm an addict. You know what happens? I have an abnormal reaction to life. And so I smoke cigars. So I give up the cigars, and I got the dip going. And then I'm trying to control my dip. So I said, I got to quit this dip. Now, at no point in this, and I'm probably 18 years sober at the time, nowhere in this do I think I got to go to God with this. I'm just going to handle it. So I buy the dip. I said, man, I'm tired. I'm not buying anymore. But then I go buy some. And then I take a dip, and then because I haven't had any in a couple days, irritability, restlessness, sleeplessness, dry mouth. Oh, and then I piss a lot if I dip that, right? So I'm up every 45 minutes to piss all my... I mean, this is like a lot of horrible effects. But the reason I can even experience those effects is because I'm clean and sober. You know what I mean? Because now I actually recognize that the things I put into my body have some effect. So I'm hating it. It's, oh, shit. So I decide, I'm done with this. So I take a dip. I hate the way it makes me feel. I go over and I dump it out. I take the can. I throw the can in the trash. Hour later, man. Gary, I'm over here in the trash. So I go dig the dip out of the trash. 18 years sober. Pull it out, take a dip. This time when I'm done, I realize I can't just throw the can away. So I turn, I dump it into the trash. Till 2 hours later, Terry, and I open up the friggin' trash, and I find where the wad is, where the not touched by garbage juice, and I get some. That's clean and sober with a lot of years. And I think y'all have known and know me well enough to know now that I work legitimately strong recovery. I've worked my ass off. These disciplines hitting my knees morning and night, the things that I do, the H and I work, I'm doing it, but this is where it's at. So I thought, man, what am I going to do? So one night, so I buy a can, throw it, I'm just going through this cycle. And so one day I have this awareness of my higher power. And it is this: if you want to stop, Just put it down now. I knew it was my higher power. And so I said, well, God, thank you so much for that. I'll get with you tomorrow. When I went to quit, let me tell you what. When I finally went to God, because after that, it was all on, man. And when I finally went to quit, it was hell. But I quit. You know, and I haven't dipped, right? So the point that I'm making is that these character defects show up in real life situations in a lot of unique ways. And the more we try to like be true to ourselves, the more apparent they become. Now, at one point in my life, dip or cigars or something like that would have been a one on a scale of 100 because my behaviors were so out of control. So in these are excerpts from the book Drop the Rock, and we're not going to read all, but the way that Drop the Rock started and what he was talking about is that where it came from was an original story that some woman wrote about trying to get to a place called Serenity Island. And so she was trying to swim out to Serenity Island, and as she's swimming, the rocks of her character defects are stopping her from getting where she wants to go. And so people are on the boat, and they're going, she's trying to catch the boat to Serenity Island, and she's going, you know, blah, 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 and the people around her going, drop the rock, drop the rock. And so she dropped the rock. Well, what I've discovered for myself, and then finally was able to swim, but what I've been able to find out is that it isn't just the big rocks. A lot of times it's the pebble in your shoe. It's those little tiny ones. See, because my experience over time tells me that it is the ants that eat my lunch at the picnic, never the bears. It's the little things. It's the little things that make the difference between a quality relationship with another human being, too. You know what? Bill recognized that in the book when he said that we can handle the big problems a lot better than we can the small ones. Because those little things that get at us. So this is the story about how Nell Wang and the story came in and it became an AA classic as a result of that talk. But really what it's about is it's about the ability to identify what are the things that are making your life harder? What are the things that are making your swim more challenging? Anybody here ever ride a bicycle?
Yes.
Cool, I'm gonna give you an illustration. All right, here's a bicycle, right? 10-speed, whatever it is, right? And there's all the spokes. Now, anybody ever tune a bike? Well, what there's actually a little wrench that you use to adjust right here, right? On every one of these spokes. So when you ride a bike that the tires are properly balanced, you can pedal with ease. Right? Are you with me? You're flying down the road, it's a breeze. But what happens is that character defects are kind of like those spokes. So one little character defect doesn't really affect the ride much. Just a little bit. You're still moving along the life and recovery a little bit. And the more character defects that hit, the more loose the spokes get, the more wobble the tire gets. Anybody remember riding a bike with a wobbly tire a little bit? You got to push harder, it goes slower, it wears you out earlier, and it wears the tire out earlier. That's what character defects are. They're those little things. So our daily visit with God, we're able to keep it in tune, we're able to keep our wheels moving in the proper direction. And that's what being free of character defects, being free of those rocks as you're trying to swim out to Serenity Island, whether they're little pebbles in your pocket or boulders tied around your neck. Those character defects are the things that block my experience at having a good and free, happy, joyous, and free life. I did not get sober to do misery. I did not get sober so that I would... just go through life like, sucks. Right. I didn't get in a relationship with my woman to be pissed at each other all the time in a fight. You know, I didn't have kids so that I could be at odds with them. I didn't, you know what I mean? It's not what I'm here for. I want to have the full experience of being fully alive. And the character defects, like it said in the beginning of this workbook, are like glass blocks, so you don't necessarily see them stacking up. Character defects like sloth, laziness, how right where you're at right now, ask yourself a real simple question. Where are you at with sloth? Wherever you live, are you helpful? Do you help clean? Do you help participate in the chores of the household? Every one of us lives someplace. Are you part of that? And do you help with joy? Or is it a grudge? You know what I mean? Those are character defects. Character defects are not just pride, lust, envy, avarice, gluttony, sloth. They're not just those big words. They show up in the little ways that we act. The little ways that we act. So it's kind of like this. It's like surrender. It was said by, I think it was William Booth, who was the head of the Salvation Army. He said that the measure of a man's strength or a person's strength is found in the depth of their surrender. So if I'm fully surrendered, you use the word surrender to describe that date when you got clean. 1-1-2015. And he used, that was the date that he surrendered. Well, so every day I hit my knees, like I said, to start my daily surrender. At the end of my day, I get on my knees and I do a nightly review. I fight like I train, so I train. But so I'm working at this stuff, and so I'm aware of what those defects are. Am I participating in my own recovery with love, with joy? If I'm not, there's a defect of character. I may be going through the motions, but I'm not doing it with love. And so it applies. It's so easy to look at that's checking it, man. That's really checking it. I want to drop that rock. What Bill wrote in his story is, this is on page 7. I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since then. Bill's story. But anybody who knows Bill's story knows that Bill spent the rest of his life, after he wrote the 12 and 12, Bill spent the rest of his life fighting his character defects. Spent the rest of his life in the quest for something called emotional sobriety. And what he said is that his character defect, he recognized his primary defect was his, what he called, nearly absolute dependence upon other people to supply him with this sense of well-being. In other words, I'm okay if everybody around me is cool and okay. That's a horribly unsatisfying way to live. My wife, Dawn, is involved in Al-Anon and Kohanon. I believe that Kohanon and Al-Anon were started, this is my own insanity, that they were created to give the spouses something to do while we in recovery were doing the heavy lifting and getting clean. I recognize that that is absolutely wrong. The actual truth is, once a book says drugs and alcohol are but a symptom of a deeper problem, when the drugs and alcohol are gone, I'm left with me. And so then as I deal with these character defects, I have been going to Al-Anon and Kohanon speaker meetings and conventions since like the last 10 years. In my experience, the best shares that I ever hear in those rooms. And the reason is they're not necessarily the most polished speakers in the world. But they are people that are talking about, they're people that are surviving when their loved one is out smoking crack. You know, they're surviving, and not just surviving, but they're thriving. I saw this old woman speak, and she was like cool and perfect and probably in her 80s, and she talked about her entire life with a son who was a drug addict. And how her husband of 50 years kept giving him money. And she hated that because she knew he was enabling his behavior. But she was totally at peace whether her son was sober or not. I do not have that kind of recovery. I am totally cool if everything's good. But when shit ain't the way I like it, I don't like it. And so what I've learned is that these character defects, that we can really, the power of this program to allow people to find peace no matter what the external circumstances. That's what Bill quested for. He recognized his primary problem was a near absolute dependence upon other people instead of God. So there's so much we can learn. On the last page for your workbook, it's got what rocks do you need to drop, and then you can write some in. The ones that I wrote on the plane coming over here, I wrote pride, impatience, and then I wrote fear of success, which is an interesting one for me to come up with because I just retired recently. But, you know,
what was it?
Pride, impatience, fear of success, I put those on three of my big rocks. And the rocks are various sizes. And it was interesting for me because, like, I do a lot of projects and I'll take them halfway. I've written stories and books halfway. I don't know. I don't do the other half. But whatever. More will be revealed. So I take my list of character defects. I read them over. I ask myself two questions. Once you're done going through your own stuff, looking at character defects, looking at it in your life experience, how's it showing up? Where are your character defects showing up in your life? Not just the big words we hear, but how's it showing up in your day-to-day living? So when we get there, then you ask yourself two questions. Why are you holding on to these things? And what did these things ever do for you? See, I got to give it to a higher power. And my higher power does the very best that he can with whatever he's got to work with. Trying always to come up with the best possible outcome. So that's it for the workshop number 3. So all this stuff, take it and use it, right? So do you guys want to go straight into 4 right now? You want to break? You want to smoke? What do y'all want to do?
Keep going.
Let's do the next one.
Yeah.
We cool with that? If anybody's got to leave, there's ones up here that you take with you. Okay, let me get this ready. I'm going to put on the music for the next one.
I love your property for later. where I keep all my important documents.
Ready to do this?
Yes, sir.
Okay, here we go. Okay, Daily Disciplines, workshop number 4, The Keys of the Kingdom. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. So here we go. We're going to go through this workbook and the next one pretty quickly, right? So we'll wrap up this workshop. Anybody that needs extras, we have them. So the first thing is on page 2, on awakening. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider our plans for the day before we begin. We ask God to direct our thinking, especially ask Him to be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, self-seeking motives. That's page 86 of the big book. So here's what I do. I wake up in the morning, on awakening, I roll out of bed, I hit my knees, I ask God to guide and direct my thinking. Then when I'm done with that, I'll go take a piss. But the first thing that happens before anything is those knees. That first surrender of the day. Then I go out, put some coffee on. Me and my wife like to read and meditate together. So we'll do a reading. But if we're separate, we're still, you know, we both are responsible for our individual programs of recovery. So do morning readings and then meditation. And I listed a few like Zen or mantra meditation. My experience is Zen breathing really effective. Yeah, so Zen breathing is super effective. The meditations that have taken me the deepest in my life experience have been mantra meditation. And I put in a mantra. This was a mantra that was given to a man named Thomas Main, who then went on to start the World Center for Christian Meditation. And he said that a word that you meditated to that didn't have a direct meaning tied to it would take you deeper. Now, I've done this practice at times for 20 minutes. And just sit there. Mantra meditation, 20 minutes. Maranatha. Maranatha. And if you stick with meditation, and you find your own rhythm for it, right? But so, the way that he described it is all consciousness begins at some regular level. Every meditator in the world, whether it is the Dalai Lama or one of us, starts off at the exact same place, right here, right now. So what happens is it says you start off and you start saying your mantra. You just stay true to it. You don't think about it. You just try to sit there and just say it. It may work better for you, Mara. Natha, on the in-breath, whatever rhythm works for you, pick a different word if that one doesn't. But what he said is that as you do this, you start to go deeper. I always have to set a timer before I meditate, and I have to watch the first seconds tick off on the timer. If I don't do that, within a minute or two of my meditation, I'm thinking, Did I set that shit? Is this done yet? And you know, it just gets him. So I have to watch the first set. So as you start to go deeper in the meditation, and you do go deeper, I promise you, as you start to do this, these are things that have been proven over thousands of years of people's experience. And what meditation brings is peace and all sorts of stuff. He said the first thing that you're going to hit is this area right here. He calls this one of two things, either the grocery list or the to-do list, or he calls it white noise. Just static, right? So I'm sitting there, everybody meditates, experiences this. So you start meditating, you're getting quiet, you're sticking with your mantra, you're just saying your word, and the next thing you know, man, I'm thinking about, I wonder what time is done, I got to turn around and I got a training run today, or I'm meeting my brother for lunch, or whatever it is, I will have that experience where my mind, I will recognize, is now someplace completely different than where it started. Once that realization is occurred, he said, all you do is very gently bring your mind back to the mantra. You don't judge the fact that you've been daydreaming and tripping. You just bring it back to the mantra. And as you stay with it, eventually you work your way through the white noise. He said, then you hit another area in meditation where the wavelength is different. And that wavelength is called unresolved life issues. It's deep shit. This woman that I just adore in Arizona, she's cool. She's Jedi Knight badass. And she says, when the waves come, you got to go deep. Anybody who's ever been in a surf and that big wave's coming, man, if you don't go under, you're going to get your ass beat. And so that's really what this premise is. So you sit there, and then that's where you may encounter some things that are a little freaky, right? You may encounter sorrow, deep wounds. You don't really know what's going to happen, but it's going to get there. Now, as you work your way through that, he said you will enter into a place where it is though you aren't even saying the meditation anymore. It's as though you're hearing it from the mountaintop, echoing through the canyons. And then, this was Thomas Main's experience. He was a British military officer who was overseeing a part of Indochina that had tremendous strife, poverty, and war. And in his deal, one of the areas that he was at, one of the islands that he had command over, was an island of peace and prosperity. And so he was sent by Her Majesty to go to that place, find the leader, and thank them for all that they had done to bring, you know, harmony to that area. And what he found at the center of this culture were meditators. And they were all taught by the leader of their village who taught them all to meditate, who that became his meditation teacher. And in this place, now all the other people with the same basic situations were all in a radically different place. At war, poverty, discord. And here was this place of peace. And the only difference was they were meditators. And so he was taught meditation by this man. And then he went on to devote his life. He left the military and became a priest. And then he encountered somebody who said, hey, look, a boss in the priesthood who said, I don't believe in that meditation shit. That's witchcraft, voodoo bullshit. Don't meditate. And because of his obedience, he didn't. And it went for 6 years without meditating. And then something changed. They put him in a school for troubled boys. And he was in a school filled with delinquents and hoodlums. See some of his students here. So he got permission from the person, the bishop he was under, said, I want to teach meditation. Brought meditation in there. Delinquency decreased, crime decreased, grades went up, scores went up, kids started graduating, all because of this same mantra meditation. That's his mantra. Maranatha. That was the words that he used, so those are the words that I use. So when I do this, so here's what he experienced. And I've experienced yes, 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 where I hear it like it's coming from a mountaintop. It's as though I'm not even saying the word anymore, and I can just feel it and hear it in my consciousness. What he recommends is this, 2 times 20, 2 20-minute meditations a day. So I spent a couple of years studying this, and I will tell you that in those couple of years, I probably did the 2 times 20, 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 times. You know, even knowing all the fruits of it, still lacking the ability to discipline myself sufficiently to be able to apply myself. Because here's the last thing that he said that happens. As you do this, and I think I got a glimpse of this one time. He said you will find yourself on the other side. The other side. The other side of consciousness. And what he said you will experience is you will find yourself in the presence of divine love. In the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says deep down inside every man, deep. Remember, here's where we start. This is present moment. Deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And it goes on to say that in the final analysis, it is only there that that contact can be made. That's what he's talking about. That was his journey to get to here. And he said, and you find yourself, you and the indwelling God, together. He said, and when you have the realization that you are in the presence of divine love and God, he said, you've blown yourself out of the meditation again. Go back to your mantra. It's a hell of a practice. See, we can grow in so many ways, right? So whatever form of meditation, then underneath it you put, you see I put time, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. Some days, man, I get like 20 in the morning and the 30 in the afternoon. My wife and I created a new word, which is our afternoon practice. We call it naptation. Nice. Because we go into the meditation fully knowing that we may fall asleep in the meditation and not caring whether we do it, right? So I love my afternoon adaptations. Something to look forward to retirement. Okay, so we fight like we train. In the big book it says, the day will come when we are defenseless against the first drink of drug. Our defense must come from a higher power. I don't know what day that's going to be, right? I have no idea when that's going to happen. So if I'm trained up, if I'm prayed up, that's why I hit my knees every morning. The first act of my life is to hit my knees every morning in recovery. And the reason that I do that is it's not a sign for you, it's one for me. Because I want to know that if shit hits the fan, I'm, you know, when that day comes where the stress, the strife, whatever it is, and it's there, my defense, I want to be powered up. You know what I mean? I don't want to, you know, I don't want to go to that gunfight with a pocket knife. I want to be prayed up. And so that's why I do that stuff. So the next page on page 3, spot check inventory. That's what's done, as Bill said, during the day's march. Take a look in the mirror and what do you see? Is it the person you want to be? Practice looking in the mirror instead of looking for excuses. Practice looking in the mirror instead of looking for excuses. So here's part of my daily, this is part of my daily work. And I give this sheet, one sheet in entirety with these 3 sections that we're going through. And I give, it's all on one sheet, right? So the top part of the sheet will say on awakening. Then the second part of the sheet will have the spot check inventory. The spot check inventory is, call friends in the program. Include someone you don't normally call. That's expanding your influence. And it's also expanding the love. And you never know, the person that you call, you may save their life. They may save yours. And the more people that I call, the more likely I am to receive a call. See, because I get jammed up. Now, I've been doing this for 27 years, right? So I could pick up the phone and call anybody. When I was 27 days, the idea of calling someone was horrifying to me. The phone felt like it was 1,000 pounds. So I can't emphasize enough that we fight like we train. I got to be trained. So daily disciplines. So I call friends in the program, including someone that I don't normally call. And I'm going to give you another tool that I don't think is in one of these workbooks. And it's probably one of the most effective tools that I know of getting out of a bad space. So we all get bad spaces. It doesn't matter who you are. I've never met anybody who didn't have bad spaces. And so, you know, sometimes I'll pray or try to work with others. Nothing works. Sometimes I'm jammed. Sometimes it's just like, shit, I'm just in a bad place. What I found that is really, really effective is I tell my guys, I go, I want you to call a few people, 3 to 5. And I want you to call them and say, how are you? And they're going to say this, oh, I'm fine. How are you? Don't take the bait. I didn't call for that. So if the conversation is me and Lindsay, I'll go, hey, Lindsay, what's happening? This is Terry. How are you doing?
Doing good, man. How are you?
Oh, I'm cool. You know, things are good. Whatever. You know, I just wanted to see what's happening with you. I was thinking about you. And I keep putting it back on them. And what happens, someplace, if you make that call 3 or 4 or 5 times, first of all, people love that, man. There's two things people like to talk about, themselves and others. So you know what I mean? You're able to, like, you start talking to somebody, and at some point or another, you're going to talk to somebody, they're going to say to you, man, I'm really glad you called, you know. I'm in a bad space. You don't talk about what you're experiencing anymore. Because when I'm in that obsessive, compulsive, just I'm on that hamster wheel. I'm just by calling other people, it gets me out of it. It's super effective. Okay, another thing I have here is call or visit family or old healthy friends. Now, I put healthy friends. That means I don't go look for the dudes I used to get loaded with. God puts them in my path anyway when they're supposed to. But the reason is I had a period in my recovery where I was doing all this recovery work and I'm sponsoring guys and my phone's ringing off the hook all the time. It's new guys and step work and an older guy. And I'm ignoring my brothers and sisters and my loved ones without consciously being aware that that's what I'm doing. So I put that into my day's stuff. So then what I do, I'll call one of my brothers or one of my sisters and say, hey, what's happening? How are you? I was thinking about you. I love you. Or whatever it is, you know. Just to expand that. I was at a funeral for a guy who was a warrior, extreme in recovery. And when he died. He was a delegate. He was friends with Bill W. I mean, this was a baller, right? And at his funeral, the church was packed. And it was all people in recovery. And I thought, man, where's the family? One son. And when the eulogies were done, my buddy, who I sponsored, sitting right behind the son, or right next to the son, excuse me, and the son starts going like this during the eulogies. It's huffing, puffing. He goes, what's up, man? He goes, all these people saying all this nice shit about him. How come I never saw it? I don't want to be that man. I don't want to neglect my family in the process of my recovery. My family went on the journey to hell with me. So I want to have them accompany me on the slow ride. You know what I mean? I want them to be there with me as we do the rest of it. So I reach out to them. That doesn't mean if you call some family member, it says healthy friends, right? And if I have unhealthy relatives, I have a couple of relatives that are a little on the edge. And when my wife and I are going over to their house, if we're going over for dinner, the question isn't what's for dinner, it's who's for dinner. You know what I mean? But in spite of that, I still go, but I know where I'm going and I meet them on their turf, right where they're at. I'm not there to change them. But so what I want to do is I want to have a well-rounded recovery. Then I have, you know, call or email your sponsor, text or whatever it is, go to a meeting, exercise. For me, exercise is vital. I got into distance running because I had to. It was the Kohanon steps and distance running that brought my anxiety levels down to where I could live and breathe. Electric razor, electric toothbrush, take your choice. I wake up in the morning like an electric razor, electric toothbrush on high. That's how I've been waking up. That's how I woke up for probably the first 15 to 20 years of my recovery. Doing all the work. It's just how I'm wired. I told my doctor, right? My doctor's a naturopath. I said, my blood pressure is higher when I wake up in the morning than it is after a day of managing a huge number of employees. In a stressful day, my blood pressure is higher in the morning. And he goes, no way. I go, oh man, I promise you, way. There's a line in the book, bodily and mentally different than our fellows. This isn't the case for everybody. So I got a blood pressure cup. I check my blood pressure every Monday morning. Because of this addition of a really deeper look at my internal condition along with my running, now, like, my blood pressure's like cool, like, you know, 118 over 80 with a heart rate of 52 or something. You know, it's like, it's super low. But when I first started taking it, blood pressure this high when I wake up. So when I got up in the morning, every morning in my addiction, I would wake up, and the first thing I'd do is I would go over to the cupboard, and I would open that cupboard in my bedroom, and I would take 15 Percocets. Sounds like a lot, but they were just 5. So I know that it's gotten out way beyond. But it wasn't. It didn't start out at 15. But after a while, it took 10 to 15 perks to get any kind of relief. And then the blood pressure. So you talk to alcoholics anywhere in the world, and you say this to them. You go, you have that first drink. There's a line in the book that says that we get the ease and comfort right at once from a drink. Drinks we see others take with impunity. Well, what's the sound of a drink? What is it? What's the sign of that first time that that heroin or that crack hit or whatever it is? Prayer, meditation, exercise have done the same thing. So, good daily disciplines, right? So that's why I exercise. Then I put on there, eat healthy foods. Reasonable portions of godly foods, fruits, vegetables, or foods that make me feel good about me. Now, when I was in treatment, they asked a question. It was a very cool question. I'm going to put it up here for a sec just because I like to write on the board. It makes me feel like I was a teacher or something, even though I failed horribly in school. So I was in treatment, and they wrote this on the board. I like myself best when. It's a hell of a question. But for me, I like myself best when I. Give me one.
I'm honest.
Honest. Anybody?
Centered.
Centered. When I pray. When I meditate. When I exercise. When I eat right. You ever eat like shitty food and a lot of it? And go, oh, God, I feel like shit, right? So that's this deal, man. I like myself best when. So I like myself best when, right? So I'm trying to live my life more in tune with that. And then I have find something to be grateful for and do or say something nice. I pay attention to my thoughts. What am I obsessing about? The Buddha said the human mind is like a tree filled with monkeys. So now we got just a line of one song coming up here as we turn to the page. Doesn't it say nightly review? Is that the page we're on?
Yes.
Okay, so this is what happens to me every time I hear nightly review. You're going to love this. Maybe. Maybe not. But this is what I hear in my head. This is what happens.
I'm on!
just switched to some Al Green, man. But what I hear is, all aboard! And I hear in my head, lock and load, motherfucker! That's what I hear. Now, the reason I hear that as part of my nightly review is this. I believe that the nightly review is one of the most important things that is done in our recovery. Because that is the place where we continue to watch for, and it gives us all the things we got to watch for, right? But what I got to watch for is this, man. I got a lot of experience. I have a sponsee who is a stroke victim. And it was, at one point, the man was my sponsor a long time ago. And then he relapsed and went to prison. And I started sponsoring him when he was in prison. That was more than 20 years ago. And I watched him just do great in Cocaine Anonymous, right? But he was a gambler. And he loved going to those casinos, right? And I watched, he was a gambling addict. It's perfectly fine, gamble, do it, it's all good. As long as it isn't an issue for you. But how do I determine the two? That's what Nightly Review does. So what happened to my buddies, he went further and further into the gambling. And it started to stress him out, right? And then I watched gambling do to this man what a crack pipe does to any man or woman who smokes it. I watched him lose his marriage. I watched him lose his car. I remember one day, Phoenix, and he's a big old dude too. I see him pedaling a bike in like 112 degree temperature. Car smoked up. And this is all over the casinos. They build casinos out where we're at everywhere. I was just in Montana last weekend, and all the casinos are combined with liquor stores. Dangerous. You know, they ain't building Las Vegas or these casinos on people's winnings. And so what, and it isn't about winning or losing for addicts, it's just about feeding the beast. And he had a stroke as a result of stress. And then as he recuperated from that first stroke and started to do better, and I mean a debilitated, jaw dropping, grueling, you know, and I watched him start to come back. And then the very first thing that he did, once he got back into the home with his wife, things started working out. He called for the bus, and the bus picked him up. The casino bus picks him up at the house. And he had another stroke. This time, he ain't never coming back. This time, I sit with my friend. I go to visit him all the time. I still take him to meetings. Still take him to the home group. One of the last times I took him to a meeting, he shit himself in my car and shit all over my seats. I'm not giving his name, and I'm not. I'm just telling you that there are character defects. I have watched an incredible number of good people end up in extramarital affairs. Here's how it happens. Go to work, you're working good, new girl comes in the office, hey, what's happening, you know, and she's nice to you, and you seem on the surface to be, you know, electric, getting it down, we're clean and sober. We are incredibly attractive people in the workplace and in the relationship field too. So here you are, next thing you know, man, there's a good girl, I call it. You know, she's over there, a little low-cut, slinky, and I call it. So you walk by her desk, hey, what's happening, how you doing? You know, even though you're going that way, but you go this way to go that way. I call that titty hawking. Right? That's just what I call it, because that's what it is, right? So people are doing that stuff. Well, what a night review does is that when we review our conduct, I will then be able to say to myself, man, I felt that trip to the casino right here. You know, or you'll recognize, uh-oh, man, something's going on. You know, I got this attraction with this other woman. Sometimes it's not the workplace, sometimes it's the meeting place. I remember when I was like a year or two sober, beautifully attractive young woman. Me and my wife are healing, and she comes up to me. She walks up to me one meeting, and she goes to give me a hug. Well, when she hugs me, she takes one leg and wraps it around the back, pulls me in tight for a hug. That's a little weird, right, in the rooms to get hugged like that. If anybody hugs you like that, no, that is not okay. And she said to me, when you and Donna break up, I'm going to fuck your brains out. You know, and I thought, I was taken back. I don't know what to say about that, right? I mean, I'm in the rooms of recovery. I'm thinking this shit is, you know, this isn't right. But then when I'm sitting, but in my nightly review, and then I notice when I go back to that meeting, you know, I see her and just give a smile because I know what kind of hug I'm going to get. And then I thought to myself, man, listen, I picked it up and I thought this is really unhealthy. I stopped going to that meeting. I wouldn't go to that meeting anymore. Because I'm not going to put myself, I'm not going to tell her about herself. I'm not going to tell my wife, hey, that's what this bitch is. I'm not going to do any of that. But the deal is because I have a practice in place that happens 365 days a year and 366 in leap years. I have a practice where I get on my knees. I go through the real simple process. You know, whatever, you know, what's going on in my life. And it's right there. Because here's why it's vitally important. If I won't look at it, I'm going to stop doing it, and I'm going to stop praying. So let's say I engage in dishonest behavior. I go to that casino, or I keep flirting with that woman, and I'm in a committed relationship. You got to ask yourself, what's good for the goose, good for the gander? Would you like it if your partner was flirting with someone else? I wouldn't particularly care for that. That's not what I want my relationship to be based on. You know, I want it to be based on trust and respect. So, if I keep engaging in that behavior, what am I going to do? Okay, we ask God what corrective measures should be made. Hey man, change your behavior. But I keep doing the same thing, then I only have a choice. Either get numb in my prayers, blah, blah, blah. Or stop praying. And then when I take that step out, I'm in trouble. It's a 12-step program. Pull one out, there's a good chance that you may have pulled out the one vital piece that is that part of that effective defense that we have to have. So I hear Ozzy. We constructively review our day. Were we resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do we owe an apology? If we kept something to ourselves, should it be discussed with another person at once? Were we kind and loving towards all? Nightly review questions. Was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid? Do I owe an apology? And then I have added, do I see any old patterns in my life today? Am I starting to try to impress people? What's happening? Have I kept something to myself that should be discussed? Was I thinking of myself most of the time? Was I seeking attention and validation? Where did my sex powers come into play? Did I use them wisely? Where am I not trusting God? What could I have done better? Was I grateful today? More questions on the next page. Was I a good friend today? Was I a good partner today? Was I a good father today? Did I show gratitude for my children, my parents, my siblings today? Did I work when I was at work today, or did I slack? Did I communicate today, or was I shut down? Am I isolating and not talking about what's really going on with me? Am I judging myself or someone else without mercy today? Judging myself without mercy. You know, being too harsh a critic on myself. Do I remember that I can ask for help today? After making these corrective measures, we ask for God's forgiveness. We ask what corrective measures should be taken. I ask God to remove it, discuss it with someone, make amends quickly, turn my thoughts to someone I can help, and then meditate again. How long? And then the last thing, hit your knees at bedtime, thank God for another day of sobriety and love your life. All of that is on one sheet. Right? All of that's on one sheet. I call it Daily Goals for a Happy Life. Because it incorporates the reviews, the spot check, and all that stuff. Okay, next, step 10, continue to take personal inventory. Step 10 is the guardian of my recovery and my sanity. This step will actually save sobriety, relationships, and sanity. If we actually do a daily step 10, we could save ourselves and all around us untold suffering and pain. Step 10 is a vital part of recovery. I see the daily review as a watcher over my recovery, a centurion or a guard, if you will. Most negative behaviors and their painful consequences do not begin as big problems. In my experience, they start small with little dishonesties. It's the ants that eat our lunch at the picnic, never the bears. In other words, it's the little things that make or break a life or a recovery. The 10th and 11th step help me to keep my behaviors aligned with my ideals that I've set for myself. Be gentle with yourself. Remember, it says we constructively review our day. In the AA Big Book, much of step 10 and 11 seems to be intertwined with spot check, inventory, and all that stuff. Russell Brand has his own step 10, and here it is. Am I committed to daily, I like it, watch out for fucked up thinking and behavior and be honest when it happens. That's his step 10. And then he has some, you know, my compassion, do I trust my higher power? It says we vigorously commence this way of living. Definition of vigorous is strong, energetic, and active in the body and the mind. Step 10, we feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. This is how we react so long as we stay in fit spiritual condition. We have a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Are you in fit spiritual condition? And then I put spiritual, not physical, not sexual, not intellectual, not financial. It's a spiritual axiom that if we're disturbed, there's something wrong with me. And then I just put a deal. Today I commit to deepening or beginning a daily or nightly inventory practice. Some guys I sponsor in Phoenix started a meeting they call the Night Watch. And so they get together at the meeting hall at like 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and there's have some great meetings, and it's all just strictly on the review. And so if you decide to do that, there's a place for somebody to help you, okay? So, all right, turn the page to pages. We're not going to do anything on 8 and 9. I just put a steel-on-steel format in there. A lot of people like steel-on-steel. It helps them, you know. But like I say, you know, I got to be right with my higher power. I can be right with my brothers, but I got to be right with my higher power, too, you know. And so, steel-on-steel, if you're not familiar with it, read it. It's really good. Okay, step 11, sought through prayer. This is on page 10. Sought through prayer meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Here's some statements on meditation. There is a direct linkage among self-examination, meditation, and prayer. Taken separately, these practices can bring much relief and benefit. But when they are logically related, interwoven, the result is an unshakable foundation for life. Do you have an unshakable foundation? That's what the question is, right? And if you don't, do you want one? An unshakable foundation. How cool was that? That means that you're all right no matter what happens around you. So then next it says about meditation. Now and then we may be granted a glimpse of the ultimate reality, which is God's kingdom. They just said that we're going to get a view of what? Heaven on earth, right? However you call heaven, Zen. That's the same thing that he said. You know, there's power in this stuff, man. One of my sponsors, Howard P., always says, if you're not meditating, you're missing the payoff of the whole program. I mean, it's like this. It's like the hit. It's like the shot. It's like the, you know, I mean, who would not do that? I go through all the steps. Many of the steps require a leveling of pride, a paying back of the money, a whole lot of stuff. And now we get into this step where we get our cup filled, but then we shortchange ourselves. It's really not surprising that addicts would do that, right? Because I've shortchanged myself my whole life. Okay, it says, next it says, one of the greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is the sense of belonging that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We're no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. And then it goes next. Want to feel a sense of belonging and peace in your soul? Okay, then it says, in the 12 and 12, meditation is something which can always be further developed. It has no boundaries, either of width or height. It's essentially an individual adventure, something each one of us works out in his own way. But its object is always the same, to improve our conscious contact with God, His grace, His wisdom, and His love. And then next it says, one of the first fruits of meditation is emotional balance. Who wants that? Prayer and meditation are our primary principal means of conscious contact with God. So we say that our program in recovery is contingent upon, it says in the book, it says that this book has been written, the main purpose of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is in order for you to find a connection with the higher power that will solve your problem, period. It doesn't say drugs and alcohol. It says your problem, period. In other words, our problem with control, our problems with fear, our problems with whatever it is. Whatever it is, the power of this program can help us with it. And then it goes on to say, all those who have persisted have found strength, not ordinarily their own. They have found wisdom beyond their usual capacity, and they have increasingly found a peace of mind which can stand in the face of difficult circumstances. So, listen to me on this one. If I offered you a drink or a drug that did all of that, right? So we just talked about sense of belonging, emotional balance, wisdom, strength. If I offered you a drug or a drink that did all of that, plus it lowered anxiety, helped with chronic pain, helped with insomnia, slowed aging, improved physical and mental health, improves PMS, increase the sense of wellness in 100% of the participants, has no negative effects, plus it's free. Would you take that drug? It's here. But I will tell you what, you go into most meetings and if people ask themselves honestly, most people's meditation practice is
non-existent.
Yeah.
It's weak. It's got... So then next it says... what are your excuses for not meditating, right? Okay, if you want a better relationship with God or someone else, the key is to spend time together. And if you're in a relationship with the creator of the universe, you might not want to do all the talking. Silence fills the soul. Silence is the language of the higher power. Some silence every day is a human need. We turn the page to page 12. Emmett Fox again. He said, if you won't take time for prayer and meditation, you'll have to take time for pain and suffering. And then here's a couple other suggestions. Try eating one meal a week in silence. My wife and I went to a meditation workshop taught by a Zen priestess. She was cool, man. And this lady was deep. And so she taught us how to do a mindfulness meal. And so you order your food, right? So we go in there and she goes, so when you're doing it, like if you're eating a salad or if it's got bread, you think of the fields and the people that plowed them and the seeds that were planted and the rains that fell on it that grew the wheat that was then harvested. And so she takes you through this whole meditation. So then it's lunchtime, we go to break, right? So I'm in like this very, very zen spot. I'm feeling really good. I go into there and I decide I'm going to have a salad. So I give me a nice salad and I put cranberries and cool stuff on it, cucumbers and sunflower seeds. I got all this stuff on there. I put some chicken on there and I'm having my deal, right? And I'm eating it. And it's like, I'm not talking. Nobody's talking. We're all just eating and chew it and taste it. And I think about the field and the people that picked that lettuce and washed it, and I see the sunflowers growing, you know, and there's the seeds, and I bite into the chicken. I go, whoa, cock-a-doodle-doo, like whoa, that was a trip, right? The chicken was not as enjoyable. I pushed that off the rest of the side of my plate, but a mindfulness meal, right? You know, most people, what's our primary food in America now? Fast food. Get the food fast, woof it down. Woof it down. I was struggling with dizziness, right? So I go to my naturopath, and he says, I was taught this by a 98-year-old naturopathic physician about how to help with dizziness. And I said, okay, do it, man, help me. And he said, okay, cool. He goes, he hands me a trash can. He goes, you might puke. I go, okay, well, whatever. So he puts on a glove and he goes, open your mouth. And he reaches into my mouth, all the way to the roof of my mouth, takes two fingers and goes, just like rakes across the roof of my mouth, you know, hitting the guy like that. I don't gag, right? And he says, that should get you started. He goes, the dizziness will probably come back in a day or two. But once it's, then you come back and I'll do it one more time and then you should be cool. And I said, what'd you just do? He goes, well, at the roof of our mouths, because we're people that are hunters and gatherers. So we would gather the foods and we would eat raw foods. And in that process, you chew and that would activate the glands in the roof of the mouth that have a lot to do with human equilibrium. Would have sounded like total bullshit to me until I experienced it. Until I experienced the fact that I'd spent 10 or 15 years or 25 years of my life in business. And when I would get up at a table at a conference, I would always stand up like this. And I'd do it slowly because of this. And I had inner ear problems and surgeries done on my ear. And so all of a sudden they fix it all through that, right? Because that's what happens when we're mindfully. But today in the fast food world, everything goes. So it's just weirdness, man. But there's everything's connected. So also do 30-second mini meditations throughout the day, right? Pause when agitated. Got in. Stress out.
Self out.
Yeah, that's it. Self out, stress out, whatever it is. You know, fear out, whatever it is you're experiencing. But man, I just take that little breath. And what I know is that God's peace is never farther away from me than my own breath. So I put this down. We plug in our cell phones at night to charge them so they have the power that we need for our phones to do what we want them to do, right? We're all in agreement with that. Everybody. That's another one of those things nobody ever forgets. You plug that shit in because you know you need it to have the necessary power. Well, that's what meditation is in essence. It's plugging ourselves in to recharge our power so that we can do the things that we need. And when I meditate, if nothing else, I'm in the presence of better thoughts. Now, there are forms of meditation. I wrote an example how to do Zen. I wrote an example of this mantra meditation, the examination of consciousness. I wrote there, once you get that memorized, the way you do examination of consciousness, you'll read step one, close your eyes, do step one. Read step two, close your eyes, do step two, and so on. And after you've done that for a little while, you'll have the five parts of this meditation down, right? The first part is real simply that I look back in gratitude over the last 24 hours, thanking God event by event. What it does is it raises my gratitude. Then the second part is I ask God for the enlightenment to see myself more clearly, free from defensiveness and blind spots. My eyes look out, they don't look in. I need God and my brothers in recovery and sisters in recovery to help me to see the truth. The third is I sit with my feelings, and if the feelings are like really good, I'm centered, it's a great day, then I offer up a prayer of thanks. If my feelings are that I'm like nervous or anxious, then I offer a prayer for healing. Part four is I ask for forgiveness. I pray for forgiveness for all the times in my life I failed to live up to the requirement of love in my relationship with God and others. Because see, what I know is the more that I love you and the more that I love God, the more I learn to love myself. And so part five is that you then ask your higher power to help you to live with renewed hope and greater love of God and others. See, I've gotten to God my whole life in prayer, just like I'm sure all of you have in your own way, in your own practices. But what I never realized is that I could go to God for comfort and healing. I was going through when the economy collapsed in 2008. I'm managing these stores. I got a great life, great recovery. Shit's rolling. And all of a sudden, I had to lay off over a short amount of time the majority of my staff. Really painful. The first person I had to let go was one of my brothers because we had to have a fair deal. It had to be fair for everybody. We had to draw the line, anybody above or below it, and it had to be defendable, right? Because lawsuits and all that stuff. And I did all that, and I was just consumed, right? I'm watching people turn on each other. All these high-wage managers are now making a lot less. And everybody, it was just tough, right? It was a very challenging time. And I got an email from a friend of mine, a guy that I used to sponsor. And it was a story, and I'm going to share this story with you. It was a story about this woman whose father was dying. And so her dad's dying, so she contacted the local church and asked for the priest to come out. So the priest comes out, says to the woman, "Where's your father?" She goes, "Oh, he's in the room down the hall. Go on and see him." So he walks down the hall, knocks on the door, and he goes into the room, and there's this old man on his deathbed. And sitting right next to the bed is a chair. And he looks at him and he goes, "Oh, looks like you were expecting me." And he said, "No, I wasn't, but come on in and have a seat." He goes, "That chair's there because I was taught something a long time ago by a friend of mine. And what he said is that whenever he was like in need or struggling, he would just put a chair right there. And he would talk to God sitting in the chair like he was actually sitting there. And that's what the chair's there for." And the priest looked at him and said, "Man, you don't need my help. You already got it." And that's a beautiful concept of God. So they had a nice conversation, right? And when it was all said and done, they finished their visit. Away he goes. A couple days later, the daughter calls and she said, "My dad passed away today." And he said, "Well, did he go in peace?" And she said, "He sure did. But you know, it was the strangest thing, Father. When I went in there and I found him, he was laying sideways across his bed, and his head was in the lap of the chair. And when I got that man, it made me cry the minute I read that. Because I saw it. I could see that picture. I could see God taking this kind old man, running his fingers through his hair. I didn't know I could go to God for comfort. So during that difficult time, on my knees at night where I do my nightly review, I did my nightly review. But my nightly review looked like this. Instead of my head up, I laid my head flat on that bed. And I saw myself with God being there for me. Now, this is a little crude. I got a disease of sinners in my mind. My disease does not want me having an intimate relationship with God in my own understanding. It was within, that went on. You know, that economic collapse was hell on a lot of people in our country, and it went on for a long time. And probably a month into that practice, one morning or one night, I'm doing my nightly review, and I'm just laying my head flat like that on my bed. As I'm doing my meditation, I hear a voice in my head that says, "What are you doing, sucking God's dick?" I mean, I told you I was crude, right? I'm not trying to be crude, but that's what I heard. Because I have a disease that does not want me at peace or at comfort. I have a disease that wants me using drugs and hurting the people that are around me, especially hurting myself. I promise I will not tell that story at the AA meeting tonight. Okay, last one is centering prayer that's on there. At the end of that fifth one, though, where you say you ask God to renew your hope, you also take a look at what you got going in front of you. So be like, "God, be with me at work today," or "We've got an important appointment," or "a doctor," whatever it is that you ask God to join in with you. So then there's centering prayer, another great form. If you turn the page, there's a list of some other forms of meditation. I like teach your children the serenity prayer, which is in the middle of that page. And at the bottom of page 14, it says, when the solution is simple, God is answering. On page 15, Gandhi said, without prayer, I should have been a lunatic long ago. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, what lies behind us and what lies before us are small matters compared to what lies within us. And when we bring what is within us into the world, miracles happen. And then I have another example of a form of meditation. My relief is never further from my breath. And then at the end of this, to end it, I just need to tell you, man, that it takes daily discipline, it takes work to do this, because what Bill wrote in the 12 and 12 was this: all of us, without exception, pass through times when we can pray only with the greatest exertion of will. Occasionally, we will go even further than this. We are seized with the rebellion so sickening that we simply won't pray. This is the way of peaceful warriors. Prayer meditation is real spiritual work. So that's book four. Book number five is the shortest one. It's the Professor and the Paradox. Do you guys want to just do it, or do you want to smoke for a moment, or use the restroom, or should we just do this one?
Take a break.
Take a little break. Okay, yeah, because we rolled through the last one. Ahead. Let's get back in here like in 10 minutes. This next book will take us 20 minutes to do.